We appreciate you being here tonight. We are down to our last two Wednesday nights of our summer series. And since this has been our homecoming summer here at Great Oaks, we've been talking about our blessings. And we've been talking about, as we've talked about our blessings, we've been inviting back people as best we can, people who've been part of Great Oaks' 30-year journey. And so we're excited tonight to have Colton Shannon with us. Colton and his wife, Rachel, now live in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, with their three kids, Max, Merrill, and Murphy. His connection to Great Oaks, for those of you who are new, Colton was our first ever college young adult minister. He was here from 2013 to 2018, and he was great, and we still miss him, but we're glad for what he's doing. When he was here, he was taking counseling classes, and so in 2018, he decided he wanted to go full-time into that, and so he left to pursue a PhD in counseling, which he is graduating with in May. If nothing falls apart here at the end. He has requested that everyone refer to him as Dr. Shannon tonight when you talk. No, I'm just kidding. He did not request that, but feel free to do that if you'd like to. He's almost through with his PhD, should graduate in May, and he's in full-time counseling now. He's working with the Sage Hill counseling team in Murfreesboro. Let me share a few things about Colton before I let him come up here. I don't know if I've ever told him this, but we had announced at Great Oaks that we were bringing Colton to be our college young adult minister. And he had been working with the Stantonville Church of Christ, is that right, in Tennessee? And I think it was a wedding I was at and met somebody who was one of the men at Stantonville. And he said, are you a Great Oaks? And I said, yeah. And he said, Colton Shannon's coming there. I said, yeah, what do I need to know about Colton? You know, I'd only barely met him. What do I need to know? And he gave him a great compliment. He said, Colton reminds me of Joseph in the Bible. He said, God blesses everything he does. And we found that to be true in his time here at Great Oaks. He was great with our college young adults. He was great at preaching and Bible class teaching and song leading. Some of the things we still benefit from were Colton Shannon ideas. He's the one who pushed us to say, we've got to get a better website. We've had our website for a long time. It's not helpful. And so he and I worked together a lot on that to get all that together. Live streaming came through all that, a lot of the things we really appreciate. Colton's the one who helped push us to say, let's make sure we keep learning newer songs so we can have a mix of older and newer songs. And we still sing some songs that always make me think of Colton because he taught us those songs when he was here. So he was great. I always enjoyed Colton coming into the office with a new idea. He was so good at seeing the big picture and trying to think about how we could be better as a congregation. So really appreciate him. Like I said, miss him, but very proud of what he's doing in counseling. Glad he can come back tonight. His topic is I'm thankful for feelings. Colton, glad you're here.
Hello. Is that better? Oh, boy. Very kind introduction, Tim. Thank you. So happy to be back. I'm just sad too. I miss you guys tremendously and see so many faces that Rachel shows me on Facebook all the time. I can't express, I'm having trouble with words expressing my gratitude for so many of you. Our time here, the kids and Rachel wanted to come, but school tomorrow, and Murfreesboro's a little over 3 hours, so it would have been a late night for them, but they really wanted to be here, and we just love you guys, like family, and I think about you many, many, many times a week. Certain, like Tim said, certain memories, and yeah, a lot of fun here. So we're going to be in Psalm 95 tonight. We're going to start with a little video. I got a chuckle. Tim said all my ideas, like, he had to, like, slow down. I was like, I don't know if we can do that. That's those youthful ideas. I do have a lot more gray hair. Some, maybe a bit more wisdom, but Rachel may disagree with that. So Psalm 95, I want to make this very simple. Nothing profound tonight other than what we read in this Psalm 95, and we'll also be in Exodus chapter 17. I'm grateful for feelings because we live in a world that is full of stress, full of stress. There's stress everywhere. Does anybody disagree? No? Okay, I don't either. This is a video that might work. Maybe if I press it again. Okay, so this is a phenom, Shohei Ohtani, and this is Nestor Cortez. He doesn't have great stuff, honestly, but he's a big swing and miss for Shohei Ohtani, an all-star. And then Nestor starts messing with him with his foot right here. He clicks down on the rubber 13 times, which is a hilarious thing to do in baseball. If you don't watch baseball, it's a bizarre thing to hit your foot on the rubber 13 times in a row and then swing your push-off foot back and forth a few times. And then he immediately quick pitches him back into a backdoor cutter right there. And throughout the video, they're laughing at this because it's so ridiculous that life rarely just throws us straight fastballs right down the middle on time and we're ready for it. Life is usually a Nestor Cortez with a sweet mustache. It's throwing weird junk ball pitches at different timings of the pitches and different timings in his cadence to mess up the batters. And that's kind of how life is. It's rarely right down the middle balls that we can hit out of the park every time. And that is essentially one good definition of stress. When life throws us things that we're not ready for, or that we're worried we don't have enough resources to meet the demands of the stress at hand. I believe, here, let's do this. There's a few pages here. Genesis 1 and 2 would be right here. And Revelation, let's see, Revelation 21... 19, 20. Okay. So here, from here to here, and from here to here, these are the only places in the Bible where humans didn't have to tend to and contend to their human heart. Every feeling they had, every need they wanted was fulfilled immediately. It was a beautiful garden or New Jerusalem type city environment. No needs, no feelings, no longings, no hopes, because their hopes and needs and longings and feelings were met. But for the rest of Scripture, you know, primarily almost the whole thing, the rest of the stories in Scripture are a picture of how humans have to deal with and contend with the stressors of life in a really broken world. Loss, misunderstanding, marriage conflicts, family goodness and family pain, work, hopes. All these things, they bring about feelings in the human heart. And that's how God made us. Moses, David, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Peter, Paul, all talk about how God is transforming humans individually and the church collectively at the level of the human heart, the seat of where our feelings, our needs, our longings, our desires, and our hopes live, reside. And that's where the Spirit does His work and works in us. John 16, 33, Jesus says, you want a guarantee about life? You know, you want to know something? He's like, you want to know something about life? Life is going to have trouble and tribulation. That's a guarantee that the world is broken, that we will die, that pain will happen, and that life will, you know, you'll be on the way to speak somewhere across the state, and your GPS will suddenly show that you'll be there at 7:50 p.m. I'm like, oh, well, that's not good. Right? That's called stress, for metaphorically speaking. So that stuff happens, and Jesus says that stuff will keep happening. Life is full of trouble and tribulation. And then he says, but take heart. In other words, use your fear about that stress to get it into some courage. Take courage. Take heart. I'm there with you. I'm with you. Emmanuel. So the guarantee of life, that life is going to bring us stressors and pains, and we're going to have feelings about it. So what are you stressed about today? Let's kind of do a little inventory. What's been stressful in your day today? On vacations, you know, you just, 2 or 3 days into your vacation and you feel physically different. You know, and you're like, I didn't realize I needed this vacation so much. But sometimes we're so stressed chronically all the time that we don't even realize how stressed we are until we don't feel the stress anymore. There are some clients through the day that may cancel a session because they're sick or something, or they don't like me or whatever. And I'll just feel immediate, like, whew, thank God they canceled. The relief, right? And I didn't realize how stressed I was, you know. But then I felt relief and I realized, wow, you were carrying a lot of anxiety and stress about this person coming in to sit with. Stress is when high demands meet low resources. In other words, when things happen in life that you wish was different, maybe a little bit, maybe a lot. But when I get worried that I don't have enough resources to meet the demands of the day, my body starts to feel stressed. And there's a clinical word, allostatic load. It's like a backpack we carry. Like if I had to move all that mulch with a little garden shovel, I would feel stress about that because the demands of the day wouldn't match the resources I have in my hand. Or maybe you have a lot of schoolwork or something, work to do, maybe a presentation tomorrow. And I wonder internally or sometimes out loud, do I have enough resources, enough time, enough energy? How much coffee can I drink, you know, to get through all of this work, through the demands of the day? So here's an old word, fear. God gave us feelings because we're made in the image of God. We don't have feelings because of the fall. We have feelings because we're like God. We see over and 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 over in Scripture that God is a feelings God. He longs, he despairs, he's angry, he's afraid for his people, he warns them. Over and over we see God has feelings, and we take on feelings in our heart, and God puts feelings in our heart because we are made in his image. The feelings we have help us move about wisely in a broken world. Take, for instance, fear, okay? Fear is a feeling that I get when I'm pretty sure I might be or I am in danger. Like, oh, scary, fear. I may not turn out well. You know, Max, he's starting coach pitch. No, kid pitch. From coach pitch to kid pitch. Talk about some fear. You know, those boys, I notice first practice, they're paying more attention because they're terrified they're going to get hit with a baseball. You know, it's not like running around trying to get all the kids to listen. They're like, yeah, sir, okay, yes, okay, yeah. Because they're about to face another 8-year-old who has no idea how to pitch a baseball and it's coming at their face. You know, that's fear. That's fear. That's I'm in danger. My face is in danger. I'm going to get hit. And then I'll probably be humiliated on the back end. That's a scary place to be in the batter's box, you know, as an 8-year-old. So fear is a feeling God gives us to say, hey, you may want to look around and notice. You may not want to touch that hot stove again. That may lead to some wisdom. You may want to remember when you're afraid and collect some memories of God coming through for you in the clutch. The interest that would be faith. This interesting thing to me, like about COVID, you know, not every time, but I was amazed as we were going through that process how so many older people I knew who were most at risk were afraid, but not in crazy amounts of anxiety because they're like, yeah, we'll be all right. I'm going to tell you about a gazillion times where I've been afraid and been okay, right? That's faith. It didn't mean they were stupid. It meant they had faith. Well, it's an amazing thing that God gives us a feeling that propels us outside of ourselves to ask for help, because we know inherently we're not God and we're going to need some help with the dangerous world. Does that make sense? I know you can't answer that. Anyway. Courage, too. You know, me clicking this button is not a courageous act because there's no fear involved. But if a fire was in the building and I somehow saved all of you, that would be courageous because I would be terrified. So actually, even the act of taking courage requires the feeling of fear, or it's not courageous just definitionally, by definition. So what are some gifts of fear? Some impairments that I experience, and I'm sure you have experienced as well, is like anxiety. We have a physiological experience of fear about the future and needing to control. And sometimes we get into some rage territory, which we don't have to talk about, but time to talk about. But those are some impairments of when I don't know what to do with my fear. I can't tolerate my fear. I don't know where to go with my fear. I have fear, but it's getting like stuck in my teeth. I can't get it out to talk about it. That happens. The anxiety impact happens at that point. Okay, so the do not fear passages in the Bible are less literally about not fearing. The human brain cannot not fear. It does not know how to do that. God made our brain to fear, to look around and say, hey, that's dangerous. I may need to move over here. What we do see over and over in Scripture is, what do I do with my fear? Like in Isaiah 61, I believe, do not fear, for I am with you. Who do we take and express our fears to? And we see in Psalm 95, it's to an all-loving God. So let's look at that. Psalm 95. I'll read it. 1 through 11. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. These are going to sound familiar. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving, extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he's our God. We are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. And here's where the psalm takes a wild left turn, in tone at least. Today, if only you would hear his voice. Do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did that day at Massah in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested me. They tried me, though they had seen what I did. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, these are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. Wow, what a psalm. What a psalm. Desert living is the reality of the last part of the psalm, which is where we're going to focus on first for 3 or 4 minutes here. Desert living. So verses 7b, the last part of 7 through 11, where the psalm really shifts from two songs, parts of the psalm that we made songs about, and unsurprisingly, a part of the psalm that we have not made a song about, which, this is different, okay? So there's a big shift in tone from praise to an all-sufficient God to a warning, a very important warning about choosing desert living. Like, do you want to live in abundance, or do I want to live as a desert-dwelling people? So let's look at this part mentions Exodus chapter 17. So if you want to turn there real quick, you don't have to, of course. I'll read it real quickly. But the psalm, that last part mentions the part of the story of the Israelites where they have just been rescued, they got food, those kind of things, and then God leads them to a place that is later called Meribah and Massah, and they start making demands, and Moses hits the rock with the staff, and the water comes out. You remember that? Okay. So that's what we're going to be reading. Let's look at verse 1. Exodus 17. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand the staff which you struck the Nile, and go. I'll stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, the water will come out, and the people will drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders. He called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested. So those words mean quarrel and test. They test the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Okay? Pretty cool, wild story there. The people are in the desert, and they get thirsty, believe it or not. This was the thirsty, like, life or death thirsty. This is like, I'm in the desert, God brought us to this place, and there's no water here. We thought there was going to be some streams, but they're dried up. There is no water in this place. There's a lot of people here. We're not going to make it. They were very vulnerable. They were newly rescued Hebrew slaves, generational slavery. When they come out from their master's places, they're in the desert. They get to a place where they thought was water. There's no water. They were terrified. I'm not sure. I know we can't really totally understand and picture the extreme nature of what Moses woke up and walked into every morning. What we know about how trauma impacts the brain is that the human brain that has been traumatized inherently believes that there's not enough. There's scarcity. There's immense helplessness. There's terror. And there can be fighting and hypervigilance. And these people were experiencing the impact of the generations of traumatic experiences and scarcity they had lived through. When I went to Haiti in 2010 or 11, one of those years after the big earthquake that hit at that time, like 2 or 3 weeks after, it was very soon after, while things were happening, death everywhere. And one thing we did was we packed up bags of food, like rice and things, and we would just go out in a pickup truck. Looking back, this was kind of, I wouldn't recommend doing this. I can't believe we did that. Anyway, we'd go back in the pickup truck, and I would stand in the back as a college kid, and we would go to tent camp cities that you saw on the news, and we would start handing out food, and hundreds of people would wrap around the truck, and this would be at night, and if they didn't eat this food or get a hand out to get the food, and we knew we were going to leave not having enough, they weren't going to eat for the next 24 hours, more than likely. They were, for good reason, terrified. For good reason, they wondered if they were going to live and survive, because the odds were, we don't know. And many thousands died not from the earthquake, but from no water and no food and no sanitation after the earthquake. We know that. So there are current day events that have happened that help us make sense of what Moses was walking into. He was walking into even the next chapter when Jethro comes to town. And Moses is taking the seat every day to judge the people because there's all kind of fighting. And Jethro, one of the first things Jethro says to him, verbatim, is like, Moses, this is not good. What you're doing is not good. You got to rest because this situation is overwhelming. It is powerfully, powerfully stressful. And you're not going to make it long enough to see the people to the promised land unless you start giving yourself some care. So we see from stories like that how wild this time was for Moses and the people. So I don't believe that the sin was at the in here, in Exodus 17, was that the people asked for water. That's just an odd place to camp out from to me, that was the sin. Like, they asked for water, and that was a sin. What we see here is that the sin was that they grumbled and quarreled amongst themselves. You can say that 10 times, quarreled. And they tested God. Those were the sins that happened there. They grumbled and they quarreled because they believed they weren't being cared for. Now, before we start judging the Israelites, just wonder aloud for a minute, when's the last time you got a little grumbly or a little quarrely when you didn't think you were getting everything you needed in the moment? If you have to go back more than 48 hours, you're in a massive amount of denial. Okay, so like, let's talk after. We as humans, we get a little grumbly and a little quarrely when we don't think we're getting everything we need, right? So I can really resonate with the Israelites here. That when we feel unseen, when we feel misunderstood, when we think we're not going to make it, when there's so much stress and overwhelm, I'm not sure I can go throughout the day today and be a normal functioning citizen, we get a little quarrely. And we see that socially, and you see that at work, you see that at home, you may see that with, you know, like a redheaded five-year-old girl, for instance. She gets a little quarrely, okay? Starting kindergarten. Anyway, we do that as humans. And then it says they tested God, which has really, in this study for tonight, fascinated me that how that worked. They tested God, or they dared God. They said, God, almost like a dare, we dare you to not give us water. Here's what's going to happen if you don't. If you don't give us water, we're going to kill your man, kill Moses. So they dared and they threatened because they were anxious. And that is how they tested God. Somehow, anxiety usually leads us to demanding proof from God that whatever I'm afraid of will cease to exist. Take away what I'm afraid of. And I'm going to test you or manipulate you or demand that you do. We get a little bit testy. So we act in anxiety instead of using our voice to communicate our fear. We start manipulating around our fear and test each other with manipulation. We test God with demands. And we test ourselves even in our own shame when we get anxious like this. You know, I've seen parents' anxieties can almost demand that their kids take away the fear that they feel. And so they put around these massive barriers so they don't have to deal with the fear of their kid living in a tragic world. And it's overwhelming. I was talking to a guy the other day. He said it really insightfully. He said, when I was young and I left the house, his mom had acute, overwhelming anxiety. He said she would make me call her. If I went to a friend's house, I'd have to call every few minutes to let her know that I was okay. He said she assumed that I was in trouble or in pain or in danger until I made the call to her. So I had to satiate her anxiety and her fears. He said, my friends, on the other hand, they had to check in and call, but their parents pretty much assumed that they were okay until they got a call. You see the difference? One is demanding that my kids deal with my fear so I don't have to. And the other is dealing with my fear so my kids don't have to deal with my fear. Well, that's a very different proposition. And when my kids have to deal with my fear, they get highly anxious because they know that they're powerless over it. There's nothing they can do. And that's how trauma happens generationally, and what the Israelites were experiencing. They were in a hyper-intense state. We're not going to make it, so we're going to start testing God. I dare you. I dare you not to act. If you don't act, I'm done. I'm going to murder your man, and we're going to be out. The truth is, the Israelites were utterly powerless over what was happening. If God didn't act, they were dead. And yet they threaten the God that will act when he doesn't act on time. We as humans reach a level of insanity when we start covering for our own vulnerabilities, start taking life into our own control, and start acting as if my higher power is me and not God. And that's why in pretty much any 12-step program, the second and third steps of the 12 steps are about God restoring us to our proper place, which then restores us to our sanity. Because when Colton starts taking life into his own hands, you just call out Rachel and ask her, he goes insane. Really, he goes insane. He's an anxious mess. He starts isolating, getting internal. He doesn't reach out to people. He starts manipulating around the fringes, not telling all the truth. He goes a little bit crazy. Because I inherently know in my being, in my heart, the way God made my heart, that the fear says you can't handle life on your own. You can't. You know that inherently. I know that inherently. And then anxiety says, I don't know. Maybe you can. Maybe I need to. Maybe I can't trust. And that's the lie that Satan throws with anxiety that many of us were frankly born into. So let's look back at Psalm 95. It'll close out. And we're going to end right on time. No amens with that one. Okay. So the psalmist says something really important here in verse 10. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. They are a people whose hearts go astray. Another way you could say that is they wandered. They were a people whose hearts wandered. So according to probably David who wrote this, the Israelite slaves, their hearts were wandering long before their bodies had to wander in the wilderness. Their hearts have wandered away from God long before in Numbers with the 12 spies they had to wander out of punishment. Does that make sense? Their hearts left before their bodies left. Their hearts did. And so the tone in Psalm 95, it shifts as not some, prissy, angry, like, I can't believe you didn't pick me for your kickball team. God's not like, I can't believe you didn't pick me, man. Come on. Are you serious? Just a whiny baby God. No. Not at all. It's a sad God. It's an angry God that, as a parent, that sees the heart of his children wandering away. And even though he acted miraculously, even though he cared, even though he set boundaries to keep them safe, their hearts wandered away from him. And because of free will, and until Jesus, there wasn't much he could do about it at the time. So this is a God of love and care, a God of sadness that our human hearts can take fear into our own hands and wander away and choose to live in a desert instead of choose to live in abundance. And that's really what the rest of the psalm at the beginning is about. I was trying to think of something that was all sufficient, and that would be it. I mean, Murphy, that's my youngest kid. That's really all he needs in life. Sufficiency would be just that picture. He's got a four-wheeler. He's got rocks. He's got a big machine. And he's on a road, you know. He loves to play in the middle of the road. It's terrifying. Okay, so come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation, an all-sufficient God. And first we see an immovable God, the rock. Have you ever thought about, as stressed as I get about my own life, God does not feel stress. He's immovable. Well, that's an amazing thought. Amen. Like, I'm totally stressed about life, and God is there. He's attuned. He's with me. We're in relationship. He wants to hear about it, but it doesn't bother him. My life does not get to God. It doesn't stress him out. He's a rock. He is a boulder. He's immovable. He has so many resources at his disposal. The demands of a common human life are like, they're very noticed because he cares, but not noticeable. He just doesn't notice it in a way that calculates his stress. That's the kind of God that we serve. That was a beautiful thing. I hope maybe you meditate in the mornings. A beautiful picture of God is an immovable force that is not impacted negatively by the stress of my life. So I can count on that God. He's the rock of our salvation. These are pictures of from the new James Webb telescope. I mean, this God that made this stuff, it's amazing. They just found a black hole that eats the size of our sun in our galaxy. It eats it every day. That much mass goes through it. We just found a black hole that eats our sun for breakfast, you know? And that's the God that we're in relationship with. That's the God we serve, an immovable God. And then it goes on to talk about the sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us worship and bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, where the sheep or the flock, plural, under his care. You don't have a flock with one sheep, right? We're in this together. If we're going to deal with our stress and the natural fear that comes from the brokenness of the world, we got to be a flock. We're the flock under his care. Our brains, our relational brain so syncs up together, we're just picking up thousands of data points. When I look at each one of your faces, my relational brain is making assumptions of where you are with me right now. Really nothing we can do about that besides drugs and alcohol, but that's a different sermon, I guess. We've got to look at each other and keep looking and keep making relationship. The term social distancing was a really inappropriate term when we were asked to physical distance. But boy, our culture has taken that to the extreme. Social distancing. We weren't made to communicate with our thumbs. We were made to communicate with our eyes and our mouths. And I really believe that the church, a point of redemption for our current culture, is to see human bodies together, because that's become somehow an oddity, you know. And so I hope we keep meeting. I'm not talking about collectively. I'm talking about just me with you, a church. Keep seeing people and keep making relationships. Because really the limbic relational brain was like the first wireless device that we had. We're just so synced. even though there's no physical tether. And that's how God made us. He made us to be together. He made us to connect. And that's one thing the psalmist is bringing out. Like, we're a flock. We flock together. We live together. And we're going to bury each other. And that's what we do as Christians for each other. I hope that's an encouragement to you. That stress is real. Stress is part of the community of faith's life. Just because you're a Christian and you're a mom doesn't mean you shouldn't be stressed about your kids. That's crazy town. Just because you're a businessman or woman and you're a Christian doesn't mean that work is not stressful some days. Just because you're a student and you're faithful to Jesus doesn't mean you're not supposed to have fear about a test. That is just an absurd way of thinking. And God is with us. And he asks us to bring our fears to him, help us deal with our stress, an immovable and an all-sufficient God. What a wonderful God we serve. So we're going to stand here in a minute and sing a song. If you have any need, any prayer, we'd love to pray for you. If you'd like to be baptized, we'd love to watch and join in that. So let's stand and sing together.